Welcome to the Global Council podcast, where you can hear the GC team discuss and debate topical developments in public policy and regulation from around the world.
Good morning, and thanks to everyone who is joining us for this podcast. Today, we are going to make sense and digest what the new Omicron variant of COVID-19 means for England, what the prognosis for winter looks like, and how the government are likely to respond over the coming weeks and months. I'm delighted to be joined by a couple of my colleagues here at Global Council, Dr. Harpreet Sood, practicing clinician and advisor here at GC, and Alex Dawson, practice lead for UK politics and policy. My name is Rosie Hill. I'm a senior associate here at Global Council in the Health and Life Sciences team. And today we will be looking at what this new Omicron variant means and what we should take from its emergence over the last week or so. Since Omicron was first located just over a week ago, first reported to be found in South Africa, although reports have suggested that the variant was present in the Netherlands earlier than this, several countries have stepped up and responded quickly to reduce international travel and reintroduce domestic restrictions. Harpreet, welcome to the podcast. Early evidence suggests Omicron has a higher reinfection rate. Can you talk us through this new variant, what we know about it so far, and is this a cause for concern, especially when we are in a time of year with flu season and Christmas coming up?
Thanks, Rosie, and great to be on the podcast with you all today. So, well, look, absolutely, things have changed a fair bit over the last week or so. As many of you listeners know, the World Health Organization on Friday the 26th of November called the Omicron variant a variant of concern. And that has many connotations to it, and it's important for us to understand what that means and what that means also and how it may play out over the coming weeks and months. So, the variant itself is a variant that's has a number of mutations, which is different to the other variants we have at the moment, which in particular the Delta variant, which is the most dominant variant that we have across circulation at the moment. Now, as you outline, what this could mean with the Omicron potentially is that it's potentially more infectious. It could potentially cause more serious illness. And it may also be better at evading the vaccines than previous variants. However, it's important to know that none of this is certain at the moment, and scientists and researchers and the vaccine manufacturers are testing all of this out as we speak. But for a variant to become a variant of concern, I think it's important to understand the significance of it and why it gets classified as a variant of concern. And there's a number of things that play into that. One is the variant's transmission. One is then how well the diagnostics, the treatments of the vaccines work. And then thirdly, the disease severity. And then, how that then multiplies across different countries and the prevalence over time. And obviously the variant of concern, the Omicron at this point meets all that criteria. So that's why it's been classified as that. Now, like I said, if we look at some of the early data that's coming out of South Africa, we are seeing that it's, spreading quite considerably very quickly, the transmissibility of it. The number of individuals that were vaccinated in South Africa was relatively lower, so that's why there's a possibility it's also spreading much quicker, but we need more data to come through on that front. Additionally, I think it's also important to note that the strain itself at the moment is only causing a mild disease, at least in South Africa, which is reassuring, but I don't think we could jump to any conclusions at this point on what that could mean and what that'll play out. But I think the next 2 to 3 weeks are going to be critical for us to understand how the Omicron variant is progressing, but also how it's responding to, like I said, the diagnostics, the therapeutics, but also the vaccines, and what it also means for the individuals in terms of disease severity. And, with all this, the challenge we face is that, we are still in a pandemic. Many countries across the world are still tackling the Delta variant, which is obviously, like I said, the main variant at the moment. And additionally, especially in the Western Hemisphere, we are in the middle of a winter season, which increases the number of flu as well. So if you play that all into play, it does become quite a tricky and challenging time for many, including many of those working on the front line. And as a clinician myself, I'm seeing many variations of this with people presenting lots of different ways. And I think that will keep playing out over the next few weeks or so as a number of cases rise with this potentially new variant.
Thanks, Harpreet. And really interesting to understand the difference between a variant and a variant of concern. Since the arrival of the Omicron variant, the government have reintroduced some restrictions, such as the mandatory wearing of face masks in shops and travel settings in the UK. Alex, what's your take on these restrictions coming into force? Is this just to buy the government some time before some stronger restrictions come in? And I suppose the real question that people are really wanting to know the answer to, is there a risk that Christmas could be cancelled this year?
Look, I think last Christmas, we should always take as a warning about Christmas being cancelled at pretty short notice as a consequence of the pandemic. And I think actually the speed with which authorities reacted to the Omicron variant does denote that, frankly, people are going to try and move very quickly to catch variants of concern early and buy themselves more time. So just to kind of answer your first question, yeah, I mean, the restrictions that have been placed in, which are kind of are fairly minor, it is, as you say, kind of increased use of face masks, although I'd say across aspects of parts of London, which is where I'm based, you know, it's not, it doesn't necessarily seem to be being adhered to that strictly right now. So, I mean, there's a question of enforcement underpinning all of this. Effectively more testing and restrictions on certain types of international travel, and then also kind of an improved test and trace infrastructure or set of procedures for people with suspected Omicron cases. And look, I think this is obviously kind of on the smaller end of the scale, particularly in comparison to what we've been used to over the last 18 months. I think that is in part because, you know, the government wants to kind of catch early and try and test early, but it doesn't think it's got enough political bandwidth to propose a lockdown. It thinks that actually, you know, its ultimate plan A for dealing with variants of concern is the booster program and the vaccine program, which is why third doses are now being rolled out to all adults by the end of January, or that's the commitment they've made. And this is what is the big difference between this year and last year, is that this year we have a vaccination program. We've got a vast number of people already vaccinated with two doses. And so far, there is, you know, it seems that, you know, community transmission seems to be at a kind of a tolerable level at the moment. There is no suggestion yet, or that they're not working yet on the basis that the current sort of set of vaccine doses don't wholly capture Omicron, and therefore they're kind of being, you know, they're being slightly more cautious, even if they are moving earlier on restrictive measures than they were last year. And so, you know, that's kind of where the government is. I should also point out, and I don't want to be the pernickety one on this podcast, that when Boris Johnson announced his set of measures and Sajid Javid announced the set of measures that were being taken, it wasn't actually across the UK as a whole. It was just applying to England. The way it's being done in Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland is slightly separate because health is devolved in those parts of the UK. And that points to the fact that in all of this, as we've seen throughout the entire pandemic, there is a gap between what politicians can announce and propose, and kind of what actually their powers allow them to do. And also they are all playing fundamentally with how, 60 million people across these islands behave and go about their kind of personal lives. And I think this is going to be a sort of a tension that we see over the next few days and weeks as we get into conversations about whether Christmas parties should be cancelled, whether people should be going to the pub on Christmas Eve. Is that actually kind of a government of 120 ministers can't really, or will struggle to kind of buy in a population to a very kind of strict set of rules. And I think that's kind of the challenge that we're sort of seeing.
Yeah, definitely. And certainly an interesting few weeks coming up for the government in the lead up to Christmas on this. We've seen some early reports that the vaccines may not be effective in responding to Omicron. We're obviously at early days in understanding this variant, as you say, Harpreet, but if this does turn out to be the case, then why are the government and NHS encouraging people to get the booster vaccine in response? And to add to this, do you think that there is enough capacity to deliver the booster programme at the pace that they've laid out?
So look, great question. And, you know, there's some mixed views on this at the moment, right? So if we look at what the head of Moderna said recently, who has produced a Moderna vaccine, you know, he's come out and said that the existing COVID-19 vaccines are unlikely to be as effective against the Omicron variant compared to the previous variants. But this is based on an assumption rather than based on the changes in spike protein rather than anything really seen in the real world. And that's being tested as we speak. And we hope within the next week or two, we'll have a much better idea. But in contrast, you know, the head of the BioNTech who developed the Pfizer vaccine has come out saying that actually, it may not be as bad as people have thought, but actually what this would do is the boosters in particular will help people with the severe disease. And I think that's what's really being pushed forward with the boosters at the moment, is to say that, you know, almost all scientists and public health professionals out there are pushing for vaccines, because either way, you know, even if the vaccines might be less effective in preventing the direct infection with Omicron, they will at least protect to some degree against severe disease and death. And I think that's the rationale here, is that let's get as many people vaccinated and boosted up as possible. And the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization also believes that the higher your antibody levels, the better you'll be protected. Hence, the government's rush to give boosters to as many people as possible in this current climate. Now, on your second point, do we have enough capacity? I mean, we certainly have enough dosage. We've got, you know, just around 40 million or so of the Pfizer, which is where the boosters are coming from. And I think just approximately around 20 million of half doses of Moderna. And the government, as of today, also has, you know, purchased a significant number of more vaccines. So on that basis, the supply of the vaccines is there. And so that's not the issue. The issue is the labor and the workforce to actually administer these vaccines. And that will be something that plays out now over the next few weeks. I mean, this morning, the vice chair of the Royal College of General Practitioners came out saying, you know, if GPs in particular were starting to do more on the vaccine front, there will have to be some compromises made on day-to-day care that is provided across general practice. So again, there will be some trade-offs. And just like we mobilized at the start of the year when we did the first dose, you know, got the pharmacies involved, lots of mass centers set up, GPs, you know, everyone chipping in. It seems like we are heading that way again. But it's about how do we quickly administer as many as possible. And the government has obviously set the target of 23 million by the end of Jan. So I think that's going to be the biggest bottleneck here, is the workforce side of it, and getting as many people booked in over the holidays as possible. But it'll be, you know, it's anyone's guess at the moment how that'll play out. And so we'll watch and wait. But at the same time, get as many people vaccinated as possible.
Sure. So much more of a workforce and labour issue than a supply one. Alex, I wanted to ask you about whether the government are responding to this with the lessons learned from last year in mind, when the pandemic peaked in the winter months. And do you think the government is still perceiving this as a health issue, or is the new variant more of a concern for economic recovery?
There are two things that kind of I want to kind of address on this. And first, actually, I just kind of wanted to kind of go back onto sort of Harpreet's answer where he talked about workforce. What I think you are going to see as the pandemic becomes more of an endemic kind of condition, and as, you know, as we kind of go into our second winter spike, our second winter of kind of concern about new variants, I think we're going to start to see a bit of a resumption of politics as normal when it comes to things like the NHS and how it operates. And I think you're starting to see within the Conservative Party, which is obviously the governing party in in England and at Westminster, a sort of questioning now of actually the NHS's performance over the course of this pandemic. So it's clearly done a very good job at dealing with the initial surge in cases, and no one's doubting the kind of the hard work of the doctors, nurses, and everyone on the front line dealing with it. But I think they're starting to kind of think a bit more deeply about what the 12% of GDP that's spent on the NHS is buying. If, for instance, we're still seeing a huge range of cancellations of operations, we're still seeing, it is still the case that it's hard to see for many people. There is a perception that it's very hard to get a face-to-face appointment with a GP, and that's viewed not as an improvement in quality for that aspect of care, but actually a sort of a diminution of quality. And I think that's something that we're going to sort of see over the coming few weeks and months when it comes to delivering the booster, when it comes to how treatment is applied both for COVID and non-COVID cases. So in that respect, it's becoming less of a health emergency and more of a sort of just health policy and health politics as per usual. And I think also just on the economic side, just to kind of answer the question that you directly asked, I think it is now being kind of considered much more in the balance with economic questions, where, you know, in the first stage of the pandemic and before we had the vaccines, there was considered to be a correlation between the countries that did the most sort of the toughest, most suppressive measures ended up sooner rather than later, ended up having sort of lower economic impacts. And so kind of, you know, tackling the health crisis was the best way of tackling the economic crisis, particularly as it kind of, you know, it meant that you didn't have to have as much kind of sort of welfare support, you know, you had fewer business closures, etc., you know, ultimately as a consequence of that. Now we've got vaccines, and those have been kind of significantly rolled out, as I mentioned earlier. And, you know, it is now much more of a sort of considered to be much more of a treatable, manageable condition. And now that things like the furlough scheme, for instance, have, you know, fully tapered off and ended, I think that's kind of reset the dial, as it were, so that the economic cost of interventions is now being considered, or now being given more priority when also considering the health impact of an intervention. And I think kind of part of the reason why face masks aren't being required in hospitality settings is that, this kind of Christmas booking season is incredibly important for the hospitality industry. The review of entertainment businesses and how they could cope with COVID secure guidelines kind of demonstrated that actually they couldn't really cope with those sorts of guidelines. And therefore, I think the kind of government is taking the decision at the moment to avoid closing hospitality or making hospitality much more restrictive, because they do have as much of an eye on the economic concerns as they do on the health concerns. They primarily think that they can kind of jab their way out of this. And they are kind of, you know, hoping they will have caught it early. But I'm pretty sure the fact that there isn't a furlough scheme, there isn't, you know, you just have fewer of those fiscal interventions, means that they kind of are unwilling to sort of necessarily turn that tap on, especially considering the fact that the Treasury is already looking nervously at the 96% debt to GDP ratio that was kind of set out at the spending review, and thinking, well, how on earth are we going to be able to sort of pay down the deficit that's accrued and that's led to that? How are we going to make sure that we actually have room in future if there is an even more serious variant of concern at some point, if inflation, you know, really starts to bite? How are we going to be able to service that debt? And so I just think that kind of, you know, the sense that, you know, the playbook from, you know, October, November, December 2020 applies over to this year. I just don't think the government sees it that way. And so I think, to finally answer the question, it is as much the economic concern as it is the health concern.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And on the health side in particular, I suppose it's worth mentioning that Sajid Javid is imminently expected to provide the elective recovery plan that's in the works. So we'll be awaiting that in the next few days. Just to move us on slightly, so lateral flow tests and PCR tests. With these, you can't tell which variant you're infected with, but they are still able to tell you if you have tested negative or positive for COVID-19, even with Omicron. To be able to detect Omicron, however, swabs from PCR tests are needed, but not all UK labs, only about half of them, have the required technology to detect suspected Omicron cases. So for this, you need a full genetic analysis, and this can take up to a couple of weeks. Harpreet, can you talk us through the science a bit on this and what this can mean if not all Omicron cases are actually being detected through PCRs?
Yeah, no, it's a very good question. So the just to set the scene, I guess, the UK Health and Security Agency, the UK HSA, they've confirmed that 50% of its community testing labs can now assess samples for SGTF. So basically, what is happening now is that how Omicron is being tested is through a PCR test, but it usually is sent to a specialist lab for genomic sequencing, which then confirms if it's Omicron or not. And what it is that the SGTF refers to the S gene. So, and that's the element of the virus that is not present on the Omicron variant. So if you, if the S gene is not present on the PCR sample, then the case is highly likely to be Omicron. And this is, like I said, only confirmed through full genomic sequencing. Now, if only 50% of our labs can assess that, then it also then means the delay in getting the samples back, because you will have to, you know, send it off to a specialist lab and then that will come back. So the guidance at this point is that if you are positive, you do need to self-isolate. And under this week's guidance that's come out, your household and close contacts will also help to self-isolate, even if they're fully vaccinated, until we fully know whether you have the Omicron variant or not. The kind of perception is that they will increase the testing capacity, lab availability to test more labs to be doing more tests. But until then, that is where the guidance is, because we do have the required technology, but it just means how do we get it and distribution across the country in a way that's a lot more accessible, which is not the case at the moment. It's also important to know that lateral flow tests do not detect the Omicron variant. So a PCR test, which then needs full genomic sequencing, is the only way at the moment. And that will be done by a specialist centre. So don't assume by just doing lateral flow tests, even if you're positive, negative, that you know, it will not pick up the Omicron variant. So that's why the self-isolation is necessary for 10 days until you get the result back from your PCR test. And that's where we are at the moment.
Thanks. It's really good to have the clarity about why it is that we're isolating with Omicron and not the others. Thinking about this, sorry, Alex.
I kind of just wanted to sort of chip in on this. Do we think there is evidence that people are taking lateral flow tests, receiving a positive result, and then not going for a PCR test because they don't want to get tied up in the 10-day Omicron isolation? And where are we with kind of uptake of PCR tests at the moment?
That's a very good question, Alex. I don't have the data on hand at the moment, but my sense is that people are probably doing that. And the challenge with that is that lateral flow tests also, you know, give a lot more false positives, you know, it being negative or positive in general, regardless of it being Omicron. So the only advice I can give at this point is that if you are symptomatic, or if there is any of concern of Omicron, do the PCR test and don't take the lateral flow test. The challenge we have, and picking up on your hospitality question earlier, is that a lot of places now are saying do a lateral flow test and then come, or you know, whether it's Christmas parties or office, etc. And I'm not quite sure that that necessarily will play out in the right way. So I think that needs to be teased out a bit more because of the reasons that you've just articulated.
Yeah, I mean, I think throughout all of this, we're going to start to see the gap between what people should be doing and what the guidance says they should be doing, and then what is actually happening. And as we speak, it depends on when people are listening to this podcast, but as we speak, the UK government is in a heap of trouble, or kind of a minor heap of trouble in comparison to some of the heaps of trouble they've been in over the course of the last 18 months about whether people should be having Christmas parties or not, whether you should take lateral flow tests beforehand. We have one cabinet minister saying that you shouldn't snog anyone underneath the mistletoe. And I think this is going to be a challenge for businesses, for individuals, as they try and work out kind of what their own quotient of risk is, and how they want to play this over the kind of the run up to Christmas and the new year. And I think that's a real kind of problem for policymakers, is that they don't necessarily know how guidance is being interpreted, and therefore they don't necessarily know, or it's harder to know what the data coming back into them that informs then the management of the system, what it's actually measuring, that data. And I think that's going to be something that we're going to have to sort of pay attention to over the coming weeks and months as the Omicron variant spreads.
Yeah.
I think the message there is don't get any mistletoe at your Christmas parties.
Yeah, there are all sorts of reasons why people shouldn't be kissing under the mistletoe at the office Christmas party. But anyway, I'm not going to be too censorious about this kind of thing.
Thinking about this on an international level, the World Health Organization has urged those who are vulnerable to delay their travel if they're not fully vaccinated. In the UK, we've seen the reintroduction of PCR tests on day two for all arrivals, as opposed to lateral flow tests. What do we think Omicron will mean for travel, and what impact could this have on an international scale?
I mean, look, I think kind of one of the lessons from the 2020 playbook was that limiting international travel and limiting international arrivals was probably one of the easiest ways of impacting transmission, certainly impacting kind of new variants, transmission into countries, and relatively cost-free for the domestic kind of the domestic stakeholder, i.e. the voter, and therefore it was a tool and a lever that eventually kind of the government reached to and sort of was quite happy to pull. I suspect that you know, this will continue to be the case. And also, I think it's the sort of thing where it's easy to initiate the closed border. It's harder then to reopen it, particularly as reciprocity is often required to open it, whereas kind of the closure can be a bit more unilateral. And so I suspect, you know, we're going to see, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if the restrictions that have been placed on international travel take a while to come back off. I wouldn't be surprised if it takes a bit longer than the science would arguably dictate for the red listed countries to be moved off the red list. And also you combine that then as well with, you know, individual consumer behavior where people might think, well, you know, there's an Omicron variant, so there's a new variant going around. Do I want to sit on an aeroplane breathing in everyone else's oxygen or everyone else's air, you know, just in the run up to Christmas? And that's the thing. I mean, you can see how sort of demand might taper off in those sectors as a consequence of what's happening here, as well as a consequence of government policy.
Yeah. But just, yeah, thanks, Alex. Just to add to that, I think it's important for our listeners to also be aware, and, you know, the World Health Organization outlined this yesterday, that, you know, this is a variant of concern, but it shouldn't be seen as a variant of panic. So, you know, getting vaccinated, getting that booster, continuing on with infection prevention measures, you know, masks, hand washing, you know, all the kind of things that we were doing previously and continue to do, I think will be critically important. Because we do have a real opportunity to get on top of it. And then at the same time, you know, try and get as many vaccines to the rest of the world as possible. And I think that is going to be the key aim here and how we can really keep on top of this. But it's important that listeners are aware of that, because it's very easy to panic and close down everything.
Yeah, absolutely. Really important to keep up with those measures. We are at time, I'm afraid, but I just wanted to thank everyone we have listening in to this podcast. As always, if you, your business or your investment is exposed to COVID-19 and the Omicron variant, please don't hesitate to get in touch. You can find contact details for Harpreet, Alex and our sectoral teams on the GC website at www.global-council.com or via the link in the podcast notes. My thanks to Harpreet and Alex, and thank you for listening.
For more insights, blogs and analysis, you can visit our website www.global-council.com and subscribe to our mailing list. And you can follow us on Twitter at global_council.